Thank you for downloading this podcast of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. My guest this week is longtime historian of cycling, Andrew Ritchie. We are discussing his new book on the sport's early decades, Quest for Speed, A History of Early Bicycle Racing, released by Cycle Publishing in 2011. One of the limitations of this podcast is that you can't see the book that we're talking about. And there are some instances when you really need to see the book in order to fully appreciate it. Certainly this is the case with Andrew Ritchie's new book on bicycle racing. In more than three decades of researching the history of cycling, Andrew has accumulated a huge collection of photographs and illustrations. Dozens of these pictures are reprinted in his book, Quest for Speed. As Andrew explains in the interview, bicycling and photography grew up side by side with each other in the late 19th century. As a result, the early history of cycling is well documented in photos. This provides a complete record of the changes in bicycle technology, high wheel bicycles, 3 and 4 wheel cycles, and the bicycles with chain-driven wheels and inflatable tires that we're familiar with. But what was interesting for me as I read the book was the cumulative portrait of 19th century bicycle riders shown in the photographs. The images of young men and women posing proudly next to their bicycles, dressed in their riding gear, reminded me of the riders I see today and riders I know. One friend of mine, who is a bicycle racer, regularly posts loving portraits of his bicycles on Facebook. If you gave him some bushy sideburns and a high-wheel bike, he would fit right in with the riders pictured in this book. Andrew was himself a racer and a mechanic. We start the interview talking about his background in cycling in England and in California, and then what led him to start researching and writing about the history of the sport.
Well, I've been riding a bike since I was 16, and so I have pretty deep roots in the actual practice. Member of a South London cycling club, the Catford Cycling Club, and later on I time trialed in England. I raced in France. I've been living in California now some time and raced again there, toured all over Europe. So about when I came to Berkeley first, I was working in a bike shop. My first job in California was wrenching, and looking around at what was available then in the history of cycling and bicycle technology, and there really wasn't very much, and that was the stimulus for my first book, which was King of the Road, An Illustrated History of Cycling. That was published 1975. That book's still out there floating around. It was generally recognized as fairly solid, because there really hadn't been that much done in an academic sense in the history of the sport.
So a key idea that you develop throughout your book is the connection of bicycling to the modernization of society and culture. So in what ways was bicycling, in your view, the example of a modern sport?
Difficult question. Long, complicated question. I think that what I'm getting at in the book is the technological nature of the sport of cycling. In other words, the sport of I argue in the book, I think more or less throughout, it's like a theme in Quest for Speed, that the industry and the sport locked arms in the ongoing development and evolution of the bicycle. In other words, there was a kind of constant inspection by the industry of what was going on in the racing, and then the racing people were very much interested in what they could, persuade the industry to do and what the industry was capable of doing, the technological level. And in fact, in a way, what was happening already as early as the 1870s, and certainly on into the 1880s in the high wheel period, was almost like a paradigm for what still exists in 2011-12 in the sense of this close interconnection between a race like the Tour de France and the bicycle manufacturers who are always looking for the newest thing. I mean, here we have this remarkable fact that now we have 100% carbon fiber frames in the Tour de France. Now, new technology, new materials, steel is gone for racing, high-tech racing purposes. So there's this interaction between the sport and the industry, which we can trace all the way back to the very beginnings of the sport. I mean, it sounds like a silly thing to say, almost a silly truism, but until you have a bicycle, you cannot have bicycle racing. And there's no other way that bicycle racing would come into existence other than through the existence of a bicycle. So we're looking at a starting point for the whole development back into the 1860s, essentially, although you can trace it back further than that into various kinds of three- and four-wheel velocipedes, and, of course, back to the hobby horse in the early 19th century. So that's basically the theme of the book, is of Quest for Speed, is how the industry and the racing interconnected and cross-fertilized each other, so that as the machine developed technologically and all kinds of new ideas and new designs were tried, so those designs were always tested out in racing, tested out and evaluated in competition.
So I'll follow up on that. As you said, you were both a racer and a mechanic. I have a former student who he was for a time a professional racer, and now he's a mechanic. So back in the 19th century, how did racers and designers and manufacturers interact? Were they all pretty much the same group?
Well, no. I mean, that gets into another deep and complex part of the whole story, because, of course, you have in England, and to a lesser extent in America, but in England you have a quite stratified society. You have a class society where you have working class people who work in the factories, and then you have a much more a higher up level of society. You know, your upper middle classes. Who are the people who are engaging in amateur sport? And there's this constant rift within the sport between the amateur element and the professional element. The professionals, and in fact, the National Cyclists Union, as in the leading bodies of other sports, the governing bodies of other sports, had a very definitely pro amateur stance. They tended to look down on professionals and professionalism. Doing racing for money, competing for money, was considered a lesser form of sport than competing for cups and prizes. And so, of course, this was the reason that the first Olympic Games were always amateur, and professionals were excluded. But nevertheless, the people who were getting the most, who were closest to the industry, were, of course, the people who were getting their machines from the industry. And so The industry is trying to infiltrate the amateur sport and in cycling and in other sports, but there's opposition from within the sport to the presence of the professionals, who are thought by many to kind of degrade the sport. So we have this bizarre thing in the 1890s where you have a category of racer called a maker's amateur. Now, a maker's amateur was somebody who could get into quite a lot of trouble if he couldn't, he could be suspended or banned from the sport. And in fact, there's a famous case of Arthur Zimmerman, the American rider, who won the first World Championship 1893. I write about this in Quest for Speed, who came to England as an amateur, a big winning amateur, and was declared a professional by the National Cyclists Union because he was riding, he had accepted money and bicycles was alleged to have accepted money. He had definitely accepted bicycles from the Raleigh Bicycle Company. And if you accept free bicycles as an amateur, that, in effect, in the eyes of the National Cyclists Union, would have turned you into a professional. So there was, throughout the 1890s, there's this dialogue going on within the clubs and within the industry, this dialogue and this tension between amateurism and professionalism, which, of course, now, today, in the days of open sport, has significantly declined as an issue.
So related to this connection of design and manufacture and racing, I'd like you to explain to us the development of early bicycles. And I imagine that when most people, myself included, think of 19th century cycling, what comes to mind first are the high wheel bicycles. So can you tell us, but these weren't the first kinds of bicycles used for racing. So can you tell us how and when did these develop, and why were they preferred among racers?
Well, the best way of understanding the development of the technology from 1870 onwards is to have an illustrated book with pictures of the relevant machines. And that's one of the things that I did struggle for, both in all my books, I've struggled for good illustrations. And because it helps enormously to understand the problem of the technological development, to see the photographs and the, incidentally, cycling is a sport extraordinarily well covered in photographs. So from 1870 onwards, you have very, very good photo documentation of the machines and the sport itself. But so from the late 1860s, you have what's usually referred to as the bone shaker velocipede, which is front wheel driven, front wheel slightly bigger than the back wheel. And these were pretty heavy wooden, steel rimmed, not at the beginning a rubber tire, although a rubber tire was soon used, not pneumatic, of course. Fast pedaling rate, ridden indoors and outdoors, significant amount of racing. Some of that racing was much more like indoor circus entertainment than racing, the kind of racing we know today. Yet, nevertheless, cycling has a significant history as an indoor sport, of course, on the velodromes. So developing from that, you have a gradual enlargement of the front wheel in order to gain a little slower pedaling rate and a faster speed, covering more ground with each rotation. And that leads to the kind of classic high wheel period, which lasts, mid-1870s to late 1880s. Then I don't know how much detail you'd like me to go into here, because it's a quite a complicated story.
Well, let me ask you first, have you ridden a high wheel bicycle?
I have, but I ride badly. I'm not very confident.
So what does it do is in terms of what advantage do you gain with a high wheel bicycle as a racer?
Well, you're kind of, you have a big wheel, so you're kind of floating over the bumps. It's a very it's generally reported as a very gentle, quiet ride. But of course, it's a high wheel bicycle is not a great hill climber because of the position on the bike, and it's not good for carrying luggage. It's dangerous if you hit an obstruction. Headers were frequent. The racing was very pure in a sense because these were very, very experienced riders who were less likely to crash. Then you don't have so many obstructions on the track on a good track as you do on the road, so they were very highly skilled riders, and you know, neck and neck high wheel racing in the 1880s was a high tech sport. I mean, there was nothing sort of sentimental and sweet and misty about high wheel. You know, the image of the high wheel bicycle is that it's a sort of you know, quaint, folksy thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Far from it. For racing purposes, a high-tech machine. Every aspect of the machine is being looked at for improvement, lighter weight, more efficiency, ball bearings, better solid rubber tires, stronger backbone. All of the later aspects of bicycle technology that are going to emerge in the big boom of the 1890s the ground is being laid for all these developments in the factories in, you know, Coventry, Birmingham, London, Liverpool, Chicago, Boston, Milwaukee, you know, wherever their manufacturing is going on. It's a very intense industry, kind of closely related to the production of the sewing machine, of guns, closely related to any industry that demands high quality machine tools, which of course the Americans had a worldwide reputation for, machine tools, and with which you can produce many copies of interchangeable parts. So that's the key to mass production of the bicycle, is the movement from a kind of blacksmith level technology right at the beginnings of the bicycle to a much more systematized mass production level, and which you have by the end of the, well, for the bicycle, by the mid-1880s, you have this in a company like the Pope Manufacturing Company, for instance, or the big English manufacturers. But alongside the development of the high-wheel bicycle, you also have the emergence of many different kinds of tricycles and quadricycles, so three- and four-wheeled machines. Now, one of the things that's crucially happening in the 1880s is the emergence of a chain technology. Up until you had the tricycles and quadricycles, which were safer, once again, pictures really help to understand this whole development, but they needed chain technology and they needed differentials for multi-wheel machines. And so there's a kind of big expansion of interest in producing a good chain and in geared differentials and drive systems of various kinds. Actually, what's being done there, if you look forward from that point, is the foundations are being laid in that decade for the beginnings of the automobile and aviation industries, amazingly enough. I mean, later on in the history of the bicycle, you have a wholesale movement of skilled manpower as the bicycle industry declines in the later 1890s. You have this movement of all this expertise through into motorcycles, early automobiles, internal combustion engine, and then, of course, the Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics. So actually, this is a subject that really needs a good book to be done on this technology transfer into the emerging industries at the turn of the century. I'm not going to do it, though.
and we're not going to cover it here. So let's stick with bicycles. And you were hinting at this earlier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you go on from the end of the 1880s, because of the danger of the high wheel bicycle, and because of the fact that it was inaccessible to women, it was inaccessible as a really practical kind of daily riding. It was a sporty thing. It was a club activity, riding a high wheel bicycle. It was a young man's sport, both in the sense of the racing aspect and also the recreational club riding aspect. What was needed all through that decade was something safer, something more accessible to a wider variety, a wider group of people. And so thus the search for what was called the safety bicycle, the bicycle as we know it today, two wheels, steered, driven to the rear wheel by a chain. And hence the need for the development of that chain technology in the later 1880s. So safety bicycle comes in with Starley in England in 1885, 1886, develops very rapidly. And many, many different varieties of safety bicycle are tried and produced. And then very, very soon after the safety bicycle starts really taking off, the pneumatic tire is introduced, and that ups the tempo of the safety revolution in the early years of the 1890s. So, I mean, by 1891, 92, essentially the solid tire is defunct, is dead and gone to all practical purposes. It's a very, very sudden, a very quick emergence of pneumatic tire technology that really it changes the sport, and it also changes bicycle production, and it allows bicycles to be much more practical for functional, utilitarian, transportational purposes.
So you mentioned earlier some of the sites of bicycle manufacturing in the United States as well as in England. And throughout the book, you look at racing in Britain, in France, in the United States. And so I'll ask you, were there differences in cycling culture among these different countries in the 19th century?
Definitely, yes. And I think that a close reading of the book will come up with many examples of that. I mean, the American sport and the industry right at its beginnings in the late 1870s, because the Brits were a little bit ahead through the mid 70s period, but the Americans, particularly in Boston and New York and on the East Coast, took a lot of the cultural sort of club life and the way they thought about the high wheel bicycle. They took a lot of that from England, and I think the American sport developed its own direction, but it was very much tied to a club scene that was very similar to the British club scene. And those clubs, of course, in America, they spread all over the country really quite quickly. I mean, there was a club in San Francisco, for instance, almost as soon as there was a club in Boston. Quite remarkable. Which indicates, you know, how quickly machines and ideas were being communicated. The French were always a little bit different. They had a club institute, a lot of club institutions too. They were a little slower than the Brits in developing the early bicycles. But there was always much less problem in France worrying about distinctions between amateur and professional. They were never afraid to get paid or to get paid in cash. And so as the sport developed in France, particularly the road racing, the early road racing, there was much less resistance to the sport becoming a professional sport. And they preferred to categorize the racers in terms of experience rather than in terms of sort of social classification. So, for instance, you had, a sort of elite level of experienced riders, and then you had an intermediate, and then you had a sort of a beginner's level, but they could all get paid to do it. And once again, this caused problems between France and England, because if you were an English amateur, you wanted to compete in France, it was a bit risky, because when you got back home, the National Cyclists Union could say, "Oh, you've been competing against professionals, therefore your amateur status is a little bit in question." This could cause serious problems for people within the sport.
So, when did international competitions begin? Was it common that you'd have racers from England going to France to compete and vice versa?
There was a lot of international competition even in the very earliest days. And I do spend quite a bit of time looking into this in the book. The first formal, properly recognized world championships were 1893. That's the International Cyclists Association had been created in 1892. So that was formally constituted as the first world governing body of cycling. Actually, Henry Sturmey, who was at that time, I think, the most important figure within the National Cyclists Union, was one of the brokers of that agreement. They had a hard time getting the French on board because of the amateur-professional problem, and that the Brits and Americans and Germans and Dutch and Danish and many others got on board with the International Cyclist Association, which later on, of course, after the turn of the century, took on a much more French French direction. But before the creation of that world body and the first formal championships, there had been a lot of interchange. American riders came to Britain, British riders went to America, French and British riders could ride in each other's countries as long as they were able to overcome this amateur-professional thing, you know. There was a lot of interchange, and in fact, that's one of the parts of the history of the sport that hasn't really been very well covered to date. the recognition that this international level of competition was going on back into the high wheel era, into the 1880s. Yeah, definitely an important aspect of the history.
Yes, it struck me while reading the book that this seemed to be the beginnings of a transatlantic sporting culture, which is familiar to us today.
Yes, and in fact, that also existed from an earlier period in running, what they referred to then as pedestrianism, because it was walking and running. There were quite a few high-level, well-publicized exchanges between British and American walkers and runners in 1860s, 1870s. Then one of the chapters in the book is about a British racer and promoter, Harry Etherington, who was one of the first people to go to America and partly, I think, to try to publicize and sell English bicycles. But he traveled around and took on the American riders and received a lot of publicity. That was in the mid 1880s, early mid 1880s. So yeah, this was definitely this international exchange was definitely happening then.
So I want to ask about the people who were involved in early cycling, and first I have a question about cyclists in general. As I was looking at the many photographs that you have in the book, so you have many portraits of young men with their bicycles and their racing clothes, I was thinking of contemporary cyclists who are really as you certainly know, are something of a distinct subculture. And I was thinking that today it's something of a hip job to be a bicycle mechanic. And I was wondering about these early cyclists and mechanics. Were they in some way countercultural? Did they take pride in the fact that they were part of this daring, innovative activity?
Hard question to answer. I think that the activity as a sport, as a recreation, has always had a little bit of a distinct kind of cultural, physical, idiosyncratic character. A bit rebellious, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my case, it was not approved of by my family. It wasn't part of the plan. It was in England growing up in the 60s. It was a working class sport, distinctly working class sport, that was perhaps at that time creeping up, for the sake of lack of a better description, the social scale. In other words, It was infiltrating from the working class up into the middle classes. But I mean, you looking into the history of cycling in the 20s and 30s, where you had a lot of club riding and you had a lot of weekend house parties and youth hosteling activities and summer touring, and these people didn't have any money. The bicycle was their way of earning their freedom, of having their holidays away from home on the road. And there's some of these wonderful pictures of people on tandems with little sidecars and children on the back. I mean, this is a part of the culture that is now gone. And I think when we look at the sport from our present day vantage point, it's become much more cross-class based. Although in England, I think it would probably be true to say that it's still predominantly a a working class sport. I haven't lived in England for, you know, recently, so I don't have sort of such a keen sense of that. Certainly in California, cycling has become a totally classless activity, I think. The new people who are coming into the sport are coming from everywhere. It's hard to, I think, categorize them. There's been a tremendous growth of the sport, you know, in the last 20 years, and this extraordinary emergence of the new bicycle, in the American bicycle industry, you know, with companies like Trek and Cannondale and Specialized and Lightspeed Pedals and all these newly, and of course the mountain bike people. So the sport in America, and during the time I've been here, the sport has expanded to an extraordinary extent. When I first came to Northern California, to Berkeley, we were the only people on, you know, who dressed up in like cyclists, and they were not a large number of those people. You practically knew all the people who rode in your area. Now, it's yeah. So I mean, you asked me initially about whether historically there's a kind of countercultural aspect to cycling. Within the industry, it's, let's say, the people who manufactured and made the high wheel bicycle. I would think those people would have seen themselves primarily as workers. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they were machinists. They were workers, but how they saw themselves when they went out at the weekend with their clubs, I think would have depended very much on their kind of class orientation. Some of the clubs were very respectable and had uniforms, and you know, they demanded a very respectable level of behavior, mm-hmm. on the road. One of the things that I don't know whether you had this as a question, but it just springs to mind. The question of road racing is an important part of Quest for Speed, and occupying, I think, most of one or two chapters. Of course, cycling has two aspects: in a track where people pay money to go in to watch the racing, and the racing can be controlled because it's within an arena. Road racing, something a little bit different, because it takes place in public space, and therefore the racing activity, if it's a formal race, must necessarily coincide with other people who are on the road at the same time. And in England particularly, you know, a small country, crowded roads, crowded cities, the presence of these racers on the road, groups of people, was really looked down upon and caused a great deal of trouble. Particularly in the 1890s, as the sport, you know, expanded to such an extent that the National Cyclist Union and the League of American Wheelmen in America, they had a problem on their hands, because if they annoyed general members of the public with their racing activities, then it affected other aspects of what they could and couldn't do on the public roads. So the National Cyclist Union, for instance, fought a ferocious battle within the committees, literally to ban road racing from public roads. And this, of course, in England led to the time trialing culture, the early Sunday morning racing on public roads when everybody else was tucked away in bed. and they, you know, they wore dark clothing. They didn't advertise their presence at all, but they got to race. And they would be up at crack of dawn, and they'd race, and then they'd be home having breakfast by 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And that was one of the ways in which British racing took on a very distinctive identity. But it held back mass start road racing in a way that was not true, in France or Belgium. France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, but particularly France and Belgium, of course, where, you know, road racing took off in the 1890s and laid the foundations for the fact that cycling is really the national sport in those two countries.
So following up on that, I was going to ask about how was cycling viewed in the broader culture at the time. So you were talking about this conflict over road racing in Britain and the United States. But at the same time, cycling was quite prominent in the popular media, correct? And the races, the track races, drew a lot of spectators.
Well, huge, yes. I mean, particularly through the 1880s high wheel period into the 1890s, and you could say that, you know, that 90s period of the bike boom up towards the end of the 1890s, when there seems to be really an almost universal falling off of the interest in racing, although it was still high in London and Paris and Berlin and the big cities, but it was a huge spectator sport in the mid 1890s. I mean, it was as popular and attracted as much financial activity, I think, although it's very hard to measure, as much as any other sport that existed at that moment. I mean, they certainly were. The bicycle tracks were taking in the same number of spectators as the baseball tracks, the baseball fields, and of course there was as yet the football at that stage in America was basically a college activity still, and there were no professional teams as yet. It was. I mean, when you follow the career of somebody like Major Taylor, you know, who I wrote the other book about, and you see Taylor as an interesting example of an African American who's really the only African American who's entering American cycling and international world cycling at that level. And you see the number of professional riders there were. I mean, there were hundreds of professional riders in America. You know, fewer in England. Lots in France, of course. But the sport was a major attraction, and also cycling as a recreational and a fashion and a utility activity. Was widely reported in the daily press. Many of the newspapers, you know, had a cycling page, or at least a cycling column, where they would comment on various aspects, social aspects of cycling, and, you know, the whole question of whether women should or should not do it, and if they were going to do it, how should women dress. It became a crucial part of the emancipation of women and their quest for more equal treatment in society, and to wear what clothing they wanted to wear that was commensurate with comfort and respectability on the bike.
So I want to ask you about a couple important figures from the early history of cycling, and one of these is Arthur Zimmermann. Can you talk briefly about his role in cycling?
I've done a little biography of Zimmermann. Zimmermann was interesting because he came up very quickly into the American sport. He was riding high wheeler. Actually, he rode a bicycle called a Star, which is a kind of reversed high wheeler with a small wheel at the front and the rear wheel driven by a kind of up and down motion with treadles. Anyway, he started winning big as an amateur. He went to England as an amateur. He entered the National Cyclists Union track championships at four different distances and came away with three of them. Then he went back. He went back to the States, and he came back the following year. And then that's when he was declared a professional by the National Cyclists Union for accepting bicycles from the Rally Bicycle Company. And Americans, of course, were completely disgusted by the high-handed behavior of the National Cyclists Union. And they said, oh, the only reason they're doing that is because Zimmermann, as an American, won three of their championships. Now they want to prevent him from doing that again. But anyway, so Zimmermann became a conspicuous example of the maker's amateur problem, and in fact turned pro formally the same season. And then he came back to Europe 1894 and raced in France. And he was really the first cyclist whose career was internationally reported in America, England, and France, and the object of great interest. So, if you like, he became, because of the attention from the media, he became an example of a kind of modern sports hero. And the funny thing was about Zimmermann was that he didn't really have very much to say to the media. He was sort of retiring type who liked to keep himself to himself, apparently. And so you had this odd juxtaposition of hero status, but a very modest retiring gentleman kind of on the inside, you know. So they didn't quite know what to make of him. And then he went to Australia too, and then suddenly he's just gone from the sport. He retires, and basically they talk about him in the press, but he never comes back to a high level of competition or performance.
And the other person I want to ask about is whom you've already mentioned is Major Taylor, whom you've written a biography of.
Yeah, well, Major Taylor is really a unique case in the history because of his race, because of his color, because of the struggle he had to be even allowed to enter the sport. So he comes up in rural Indianapolis. He's encouraged by a mentor, Bertie Munger, works in bike shops. He himself became a machinist. By the age of 16, he's being talked of as the colored champion of America, as winning big races. Turns professional 1896 when he's 18 years old. From 1896 to 1904, he races, competes internationally, absolutely non-stop. World champion 1899, breaks world records on the track behind pace in America, encounters ferocious opposition, including physical attacks on the tracks from white riders who don't like being beaten by a black man. It's absolutely an epic story of sports, of cycling career. Goes to Paris, 1901, to meet the as reigning world sprint champion from 1899. He goes to Paris to beat the reigning world sprint champion of 1900, Edmond Jacquelin, a Frenchman. And their races in Paris in 1901 are reported as the most heavily attended sporting event ever encountered, ever organized in Paris. And Major Taylor is literally the toast of the town that year. His presence is courted by Parisian society, and his every move he makes is covered in the press. It's an extraordinary story. So he goes on to have a total of six seasons in Europe, and goes to Australia twice. There was no other rider who attracted as much attention as he did, or made as much money as he made. I mean, for that period, 1899 to 1904, you can say that Major Taylor was consistently one of the best three or four sprinters, and also one of the best three or four box office attractions. And you know, that's when he raced, the gate went way up, because even in America, where there was likely to be fouling and cheating, and that the crowd liked to support and encourage the underdog. They saw him as being the underdog. I mean, it was such a statement it was such a strong social and racial public statement when Major Taylor won against white riders.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on selling my book, actually. I have another project that's going on, but I won't start talking about it, because it's sort of in early stages. I tell you what I really would like, what I am also working on, and what I would really, really like to see happening is the movie on Major Taylor, which has been talked about for a long time now. We sold an option to the book, and the project has advanced a long way, but the funding is still not there. Mm-hmm. And I really want this movie to happen, because I think that Major Taylor deserves to be recognized for the person he was. As I say, it was an extraordinary story of and for a long time his life and career was really pretty much forgotten, except among a handful of historians of cycling and, you know, American bicycle racing enthusiasts. And now, you know, we have the Major Taylor Velodrome in Indianapolis. We have a splendid statue to Major Taylor that was put up outside the public library in Worcester, Massachusetts. And Lynn Tolman of the Major Taylor Association presided over the fundraising for that. It's splendid, splendid statue. The opening was attended by Greg LeMond and the famous Olympic hurdler.
Edwin Moses?
Edwin Moses, yeah. And thanks for remembering that. And, you know, now the extraordinary thing is there are these major Taylor cycling clubs springing up all over the states, predominantly, you know, with black membership and with a sort of taking on the mantle of Major Taylor and you know, memorializing him and taking his life and activities into the present. And that's really, there's even a National Brotherhood of Cyclists, which is a kind of federation of these black cycling clubs, which has come into existence. So, yeah, you know, I'm happy to say that I think Major Taylor is better remembered now than he was in the past.
Yeah. And thanks to you for that in researching and writing his life.
Yeah, it was not easy. The project sat in a box under my bed for almost 10 years before I got it going. So
I think many of us can sympathize with that, with boxes under the bed for several years. So So one of the most impressive parts of the book, and it is really a handsome book to look at, are all the photographs that you've acquired over the years. And you mentioned earlier that bicycling is one sport that was documented visually from its early history. And I want to ask you something related to that. You don't discuss it in the book, but when you look at those photographs, what do they demonstrate about the origins and early history of sports photography?
I could talk for an hour on that question.
That's your next book.
Because, well, yeah, in many ways what happens is that because photography is just coming into its own in the studios in the 1860s, 1870s, in a way, you can tell the whole history of cycling through the processes of photography as they evolve and emerge. And through, you know, the Carte de Visite, the small studio photographs, up into the era of people carrying around the first portable Kodaks, and then the first real sport photography. I mean, there's a man called Jules Beau whose archives are in Paris, and I found that he had photographed Major Taylor a lot, and managed to get quite a lot of those photographs printed out, and was able to use them in the Major Taylor book. So, yeah, I mean, the thing was, maybe this is the point to make here, that as the bicycle became more and more an object of everyday life, particularly up into the 1890s, you know, where it, through the bike boom, the photographs, both in the studio photographs of the high wheel period, 1880s, and the more loose kind of much more common snapshot type pictures up in the 1890s, the bicycle is something that people pose with to demonstrate their pride of possession. And this is very evident. You know, you see the same thing in snapshots from that all of us have in our background, you know, the kids with the family car and mum and dad, you know, posing in front of the car. They are doing exactly the same thing with bicycles. The funny thing is that when in the old days a high wheel bicycle photograph was considered something rather you know, special and rather expensive, but since the days of eBay and being able to see all this stuff coming onto the market, you know, you realize much more how generic many of these photographs were that people went into the studio to have their photograph taken with the bicycle. But long and short of it is that, you know, it's kind of like a parallel development of bicycle technology and also an evolution of photographic technology. But you can look at both of them and ask lots of questions about the, you know, various impacts that the development of technology has as things change and progress. Whew, that was a long sentence.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Ritchie about his book, Quest for Speed, A History of Early Bicycle Riding, published in 2011 by Cycle Publishing. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from religion to language. Please friend New Books in Sports on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can give us feedback and find daily links to quality, shorter sports writing. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.